Four and it. Okay.
And I
Hello,
think
friend.
every over here.
So, yeah, people are coming in still. So, welcome to this 65th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheading Moria Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. Previous episodes of this, the secret teachings of all, the secret doctrine, I mean, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you'd like to view. So if you miss a webinar, it's easy to pick up either on YouTube or in Makara to come back up to speed. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com. These give you live links to the webinar series. Okie dokie. Well, it will be our final webinar on the chapter entitled The Zodiac and Its Signs. We began our last session by taking a look at Pythagoras's philosophy of the decad, which, part and parcel of the decad is the Tetractys. Though it had earlier been written in the Vedas, his teaching introduced the philosophy of number to the Western world. So the philosophy of the numbers, it goes way back before Pythagoras, but he introduced the idea to the Western world. We then took a look at the astrological system of decanants and decanate rulers, which divides each sign into three parts, each with a planetary ruler. This system is widely accepted and is explored by the Master DK in his book on esoteric astrology. Also, Michael Robbins wrote extensively on this, on the idea of the decanate rulers. Not so widely accepted among astrologers, but key, especially key to Kabbalistic thought, is the duo decanate system, which further divides the decanates into 72 parts. So instead of 36 parts, which is 12 divided by 3, you now have 72 parts, which is further divides each of those decanates into two. Each of these decanates is ruled by an angel, which together make up the quote, explicit name of God. Here's some illustrations of these angels, and their names are given on here in the outer border. These angels are represented by the branches, buds, knops, and flowers of the menorah. Turns out that this is a deeply symbolic what artifact or and it's not just a lot of decoration, but this all has very specific meaning that connects the menorah to these 72 angels. Now, their system assigns extra zodiacal constellations to the decanates, which, in combination with the decanates' planetary rulers, can provide useful insights. NDR did extensive work in this area. A number of webinars that talk about these constellational rulers, that is, constellations outside the zodiacal constellations that are associated with different decanates. We then took a look at a Greek myth wherein Leda was seduced by Zeus, who came to her in the form of a swan. She then laid two eggs. Castor and Pollux were born from one egg, and Helen from the other. Esoterically, Zeus, in the guise of a swan, represents the Hindu Kalahamsa, the swan of time, which is associated with Brahma and the third aspect. The mundane egg laid by Kalahamsa represents the abstract potential for all manifestation, that primordial duality of spirit and matter, symbolized by the Geminian twins. The Masonic pillars, Boaz and Joachim, are also connected with Gemini, representing the fundamental pairs of opposites in their most abstract form. In the Tarot, the source of this primordial dualism is the High Priestess. MPH finishes his exploration of the astrological signs with Sagittarius, which MPH tells us, quote, represents the spiritual evolution of man, for the human form is rising from the body of the beast. Secondly, it is a symbol of aspiration and ambition, for as a centaur aims his arrow at the stars, so every human creature aims at a higher mark than he can reach. Decay simply says, the life of fluid response to matter becomes that of the focused response to spirit in preparation for initiation in Capricorn. We then took a look at Albert Churchward's book, The Signs and Symbols of Primordial Man, which includes an in-depth exploration of the number 12. Several other authors, including the Zohar, link the 12 tribes of Israel with the 12 signs of the zodiac, as shown here. In the book of Revelation, the New Jerusalem is described as having 12 gates, each inscribed with the name of one of the 12 tribes of Israel, but esoterically representing the 12 signs of the zodiac. The cosmic significance of the number 12 is also embedded in the 12 quote unquote perfect points in masonry, which are symbolic steps that a candidate must pass through during initiation. MPH then discusses the theory of man's being made in the image of God, where the universe or macrocosm and the individual human or microcosm are seen as reflections of each other. This is also called the macroprosopos and the microprosopos. Among the ancients, this belief extended to the idea that the Milky Way was the source of the spiritual aspect. Quote, the spiritual nature of man descended into material existence from the Milky Way, the seed ground of souls, through one of the 12 gates of the great zodiacal band. Yes, BL.
I didn't want to interrupt you. Can you go back to the signs and the sons of Jacob, please?
Sure, sure.
I don't know how to lower my hand now. Okay. Do you know in the back of Labors of Hercules, there's also a list?
Oh, no, I didn't. Is that like an appendix to the labors?
It is. There's several interesting tables in the back of there. But let me see. Aries is listed as Naphtali. Horus is Issachar.
Okay.
Yeah, Cancer. Gemini is Simon and Levi.
Gemini is Simon.
Simeon.
You know what it sounds like from what you said so far? That they're shifted one sign. If Naphtali, you said, was Sagittarius, right?
No, Aries.
Oh, Aries, yeah, well, still. Oh no, that's out of order. No, scratch
Yeah,
that.
it's different, but it's interesting though. And there's some remarks as to why they're picked. But I just wanted you to know that was there
Yeah.
in the back. It's on pages 223 and 224. So
Okay. I'll
I
look
mean,
at
I've looked at a number of other lists and none of them coincided. But I just wanted you to know that that was
Well,
one
since
of
it's
them.
Labors of Hercules, we don't know for sure if it's a
Exactly who wrote it.
exactly who wrote it. Though I frankly, even the wasn't it somebody Church that did the other interpretations for the six by
Marchant, wasn't it like Francis
March?
Marsh Marchant or
Oh, okay.
Marchant or
Anyway.
somebody? Yeah.
Yeah, so if they did the list, even that I would probably trust more than this list. This is probably very exoteric, association. So I'm glad to know about that. That's good. I'll take a look at that actually after class because I haven't looked at that appendices.
Yeah, they've got some really interesting tables in there. The lessons learned in each zodiacal sign, and they do give explanations for why the particular sons of Jacob are listed for each of these signs.
Oh, really?
So anyway.
Yeah, worth looking at, huh? Yvonne, did you have your hand up?
I did. I was going to ask BL what page, but she said it, and I
Yeah,
forgot.
she did.
I
Well,
forgot.
you got it. Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at the chats now. Okay. All right. Okay. Let's see, back to where we were. Sorry, hang on a sec. Right, okay. So finally, we took a look at the astrological chart last time called the Geniture. This is really interesting. Geniture of the World is what it's called, which shows the positions of the planets at the birth slash or creation of the worlds. Of course, completely symbolic chart, since it places the rulers at the central point of each of their respective signs. We know it's symbolic because, for instance, both Mercury and Venus can never be this far from the sun, the maximum what's the word? Distance or declination from the sun is less than what's described here. So it's symbolic, representing the which basically aligns the center point of the signs to their exoteric rulers. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. So we'll start this session by finishing the very last paragraph of the chapter, which reads, "The seven ages of man are under the control of the planets in the following order: infancy, the moon; childhood, Mercury; adolescence, Venus; maturity, the sun; middle age, Mars; advanced age, Jupiter; and decrepitude and dissolution, Saturn." This linking of the planets with the stages in human life was introduced in Ptolemy's Tetrabiblos, then further developed in medieval times. I think we did take a brief look at this. It was when we just got started that we ran out of time. So because I believe BL, didn't you say that this is still followed in astrology to determine the aspect of
Yeah, yes.
phases of
A
life?
form of this, right. A form of this is used especially with the looking at the children's charts, the moon up until about age 4, Mercury from 4 to puberty, Venus from puberty to 18, the sun at about 18 to the mid 20s, that kind of thing.
I see. Interesting. Okay. Well, I think it's worth reading again. Can we get a reader for this, please?
I'll read it.
Okay.
In infancy, the moon represents emotions, instincts, and the subconscious. It governs the earliest stages of life where a person is most dependent and emotionally driven.
And BL, if you have any further comments on any of these, go ahead and insert them.
Okay, well, this also represents the nurturer, the mother figure, nurturing that child. Mercury, childhood, symbolizes communication, learning, and intellect. During childhood, a person is curious, learning to communicate and understand the world. They're making friends. They're going outside of the home, and that's where this stuff is learned. I've also been taught that Venus is in the background, working in conjunction with Mercury at this point. And then during adolescence, Venus takes the forefront with Mercury there in the background too. This says adolescence, Venus, associated with love, beauty, and relationships. Adolescence is a time of developing romantic interests and forming social bonds. And that's so true, how he plays a vital role during that particular time. Then maturity. This is the 18-year-old. The sun represents the self, the vitality, the purpose, the you can't tell me what to do anymore. I'm an adult kid in the house now. Maturity is when a person is fully develops their identity and they take on significant responsibilities. Middle age, Mars. Mars symbolizes energy, action, and conflict. It often involves striving for goals, facing challenges, and inserting oneself. In advanced age, Jupiter is linked to wisdom, growth, and expansion. In advanced age, a person often reflects on life, seeks knowledge, and may focus on spiritual growth. I don't think of this so much as advanced age, but Saturn definitely, the decrepitude and the dissolution. Saturn represents the limitations, the discipline, and the endings. This final stage involves dealing with the decline of physical abilities and the preparation for the end of life. And this is from J.A. Burrow, The Ages of Man, a study of medieval writing and thought. And like I said, this is still worked in some fashion today in charts.
Yeah, it's fascinating and it makes sense. Your further descriptions really, it makes sense. Yeah, advanced age, they probably mean, mid-50s to 70, 75. And of course, it's a movable feast in today's humanity, decrepitude. When does that start? The very end life, whenever it takes place, an advanced age would be, that whole period that be just before that actual descent, right? The decrepitude and dissolution. So
You know, and I like the way they've put this, that Jupiter is linked to wisdom and growth and expansion. And that's what happens in our middle age. Let's call this, well, Mars, they're saying middle age, but I think of it more
Late, late middle
in the
age.
30s, in the 30s and stuff. But yeah, I mean, this is the progress of the man through the planets and how, although, we all have every single planet in our chart and we all use it in different ways, These are the ones that are at the forefront during this particular time period. And of course, Saturn, with that decrepitude and the disillusion, is also the opportunities as we hit those Saturn returns, you know, the one at 29, the one at about 60, then the one at about 90, you know. So
Right.
there's different stages in that as well.
Yeah, it would be interesting to, I know that the houses also are associated with periods of life, in a different way, not strictly in terms of the periods of one's life, but they are associated with life periods. Isn't that correct?
Yes, and part of that is the astrological signature of the Aries and Mars, of Taurus and Venus, of Mercury and Gemini. You know, so the Gemini house is the friends and brothers and sisters, you know,
Right.
and the Sagittarius house is the Jupiterian, the wisdom and growth. So yeah, there it's all part and parcel mixed in there.
Yeah, because you're more likely to be in a deeper phase of relationship with, for instance, your family and your friends, making friends, learning how to make friends in early life than in later, though that's not always the case. But anyway, the reason I think this is worth developing is that if in your own chart, you can look at it in terms of where the planets land and consider it in relation to these ideas associated with age, For instance, where's Mercury in your chart? And is it associated with your childhood or not so much? It's just another way of considering these seven planets. Okay. Any thoughts about this? I'll say what I usually do, which is that it's always more interesting to have dialogues than to have monologues. So anytime you have any thoughts or questions about anything, you may not be, like I'm not, an astrologer. And so you may have basic questions about something, and you're welcome to ask them here. So it just so happens we have an astrologer with us. This, I believe, is
We
Ariel.
do have a
Yeah, go ahead.
hand.
Go ahead.
Hi, it's Ariane. Thank you. I just wanted to add something about the nature of time. Rodney Collin wrote a book on the celestial influence, and he said that time flows differently in one's life, that one third of one's life is from conception to age 7. The second third is from 7 to age 35. And the last third of one's life is from age 35 to death. And we know, we can verify for ourselves that time speeds up. Like as we get older, we have so much less time perceptibly than when we were young, you know, when days seem
Right.
long. And the book is called The Theory of Celestial Influence, if somebody wants to read it. It's part of the fourth way lineage. But I just wanted to share that because I think that helps us plan our days and our life, understanding those limitations as well.
Yeah, thank you for that. I find that very interesting, and I think we can all agree that there's a very different experience of time, in the beginning, middle, and end of in phases of our life, and that includes what you said, but also the nature of time, what how it's how we interface time changes, so yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you. Okay, anyone else?
Yes, Maria says, would this also correspond to the psychological idea that this could correspond to each 7 years of a person?
Oh, yeah, you mean that, like the recapitulation that DK mentions, where you're in your physical recapitulation till age 7, astral till 14. And I think loosely it does. I would think certainly the moon would, being the form, fourth ray and form based and oriented heavenly body, would be associated with that initial time. I don't see Mercury so much as an astrally oriented planet. I'm just thinking out loud here. I would see this at the time of mental recapitulation. So there might be a kind of reversal here between Mercury and Venus in terms of that. What do you think, BL, on this, that idea?
Well, that is a good assumption. I'm also thinking in terms of Saturn and the 7 year is the Saturn square to his natal position, Saturn opposite his natal position, Saturn square again to his natal position as he's coming in from the Saturn return. So there's different things I think that can be at play here.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Maria. Anyone else before we go on? Okay. So before moving to the next chapter, let's take a look at the illustration at the center of the page, which when blown up looks like this. And we could we get a reader for the text that appears beneath this illustration?
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The inner circle contains the hieroglyph of Hemphthah, the triform and patamorphic deity. In the six concentric bands surrounding the inner circle are, from within outward, number one, the numbers of the zodiacal houses in figures and also in words, two, the modern names of the houses, three, the Greek or the Egyptian names of the Egyptian deities assigned to the houses. Four, the complete figures of these deities. Five, the ancient or the modern zodiacal signs, sometimes both. Six, the number of decans or subdivisions of the houses.
Thank you, Yvonne. So we'll work from the center to the periphery. First, the inner circle contains the hieroglyph Hemphthah, the triform and pantomorphic deity. Hemphthah, I've just blown this up, is a combination name referencing both Hermes and Thoth. We see the triform quality of the symbol at this in the central sun, serpent, and the wings. It's the three qualities representing the first, second, and third aspects, respectively. Spirit aspect in the central sun, the serpent representing the second aspect in the wings, or the soul aspect in the third, the intelligent activity represented, yeah, by the wings. Neumen triform is Latin for three-formed divinity or triple deity. Pantomorphic means having all forms or being able to take any shape. So it's a pantomorphic deity since it includes the three aspects. It truly is the all manifestation in one form or another. And for I see a hand.
And Veronica, please go ahead.
Well, I don't know if I'm right, but Hemphthah has the number 7 in it. Eftah is 7 in Greek, and the H usually is. We put signs on our words, which in Latin or in English this sign comes out as an H, like hemisphere, hemisferio. So the rest of the word efta is seven. I don't know if it has any bearing on it. I
Well, I
just.
think so, because the seven come from the three, and so in the H is the, what does that represent? The hemp, is that like hemisphere
Well,
or circle?
the H for us is, we put some signs on top how you pronounce the word. So, in Latin and in English, that comes out as an H.
Okay. Well, I would think that it's, it's like the seven Prajapatis, the seven who are the one, but this is the one which contains the seven. And then you have the first stage there, or the intermediate stage, I should say, between one and seven is the triform, right? So I'm glad to know that. Thank you. So the PHTA in Greek. Is that what's seven?
Take out the H,
Oh,
EFTA,
PTA.
EMTA,
Okay.
yes,
All right.
EMPTH. It's like a Greek seven.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. All right. So great that you take these webinars with us. It's really helpful. That would not have been come to light otherwise. Okay, so next, number one here, the numbers of the zodiacal house in figures and also in words. This is pretty straightforward. It looks more complicated than it is. So we see now here, I've just blown it up again, the Roman numerals of the houses starting in Capricorn at the bottom right and moving counterclockwise. The word immediately below these Roman numeral numbers is dodecamorion, which means a 12th part. Below this word, the words su domus means or house, together meaning the 12th part or house. So this ring is just a fancy way of naming the 12 houses. But instead of the first house being here, which is what we'd expect it, just below the ascendant, it begins at the bottom of the chart. Next, the modern names of the houses or signs, then the Greek or Egyptian names of the Egyptian deities assigned to the houses, and the complete figures of these deities. So let's finish the chart before taking a closer look at this ring. Next, the ancient or the modern zodiacal signs, sometimes both. Most of these symbols and pictographs are modern. Exceptions are the pictographs for Cancer, which looks more like a more fish-like than crab-like. Leo shows just the lion's tail. Virgo shows three sheaves of wheat. Possibly indicating that it, along with Scorpio, is one of the two triple signs. And finally, the symbol of for Capricorn is somewhat different from the usual modern rendering. The outermost ring shows the numbers of the 36 decanates, but just as with the numbers of the houses, these numbers began at the bottom of the chart with Capricorn starting here. We'll finish by taking a closer look at the ancient names and pictographs of each sign. First, Aries, here associated with the Egyptian god Amun, is shown as a man with the horns of a ram and carrying two wands, not unlike the wand of the first arcanum of the Tarot, which is also in a kind of Aries position. Often associated with Mercury, which rules Aries exoterically, or esoterically, I mean, though it can also be associated with Vulcan. Anyway, Amun-Ra was an Egyptian sun god who was particularly prevalent when Aries marked the beginning of the vernal equinox, hence the use of this sign for Aries. Next, not too surprising to have the Egyptian Apis, who was the solar bull during the age of Taurus. Next, for Gemini, we go to the Greek Hercules and Apollo. In Greek myth, Apollo was Hercules' mentor and could be seen as having the same relationship to Hercules as Pollux does to Castor. One of the most famous stories involves Hercules attempting to steal the Delphic tripod from Apollo's temple, which led to a physical struggle between the two, symbolizing the ongoing clash between the personality and the divine authority of the soul. We'll study the tripod, which figures strongly in the Oracle of Delphi, in the chapter after next. Next, for Cancer, we have a peculiar-looking bird-headed human figure. By the way, if any of these ring a bell for you, you know, that you've seen them elsewhere, let me know, because some of these I've never seen before, like this one. I'll catch you in a minute, Ariane. It's a bird-headed figure representing the Greco-Egyptian Hermanubis, which being a combination of Hermes and Anubis is usually represented with a jackal's head, not with a bird's head. Hermanubis was the great psychopomp that ushered the dead into the afterlife, a role that combined the functions of Hermes, the Greek messenger god and guide of souls, with Anubis, the Egyptian god of mummification and the afterlife. So it's really the Greek and Egyptian versions of the same idea, this messenger and guide into the afterlife. Okay, Ariane?
Yeah, could we go back to that beautiful calyx of Hercules? Yeah, this is so beautiful, but I just want to comment on the meaning just briefly. You know, when you read the labor of Hercules and you think about him tearing off the armor of the Amazonian queen,
right,
basically killing her, and she would have given it to him generously. And I think that this shows the nature of our relationship with the gods or with something higher, that we have to, it's not a puritanical thing. We have to earn the right, the capacity, even not just the right, the capacity to bear these potencies, you know, to bear the weight, the responsibility of higher consciousness. It's not just something that we can seize upon and assume that we could wield responsibly. I mean, we know that with the elections and everything. So here we see something, the tripod's on its side, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that would normally carry fire. And Hercules, he always had a club. It's just so symbolic of like the lower aspects of man when the gods offered him more refined instruments, he threw them all away at the beginning of his evolutionary journey, not knowing their value. I mean, it's just a bunch of exploits of what could go wrong. And then showing that at times he learned, you know, what was, how to discriminate between a true teacher and a not true teacher. So I feel like his mistakes are highlighted more than his virtues. And I think for us, it gives us pause that, you know, we want something. We want to be closer to the masters. We want, and they will give us everything. They've already given us everything. Everything has been given to us. But to go to the next level, we have to give everything of our small selves back to them to be worthy of something, some greater weight and breadth and understanding. And it has to do with generosity, I think.
Yeah, that's well said. Thank you. Yeah, it's a good description of the two sides of these labors. I think there's, I hadn't thought of it before because I hadn't reflected on it. But while you were speaking, I realized that this could represent a kind of lower and higher psychism because, this is oracular. This tripod, the pythoness seated herself on the tripod in Delphi, which was dedicated to Apollo, and from there was able to, foresee the future and give advice. And there's a lower and higher version of that ability that DK talks about, lower and higher psychism. And, one way of interpreting this, I'm not saying it's definitive in any way, but that it's that he's this represents the kind of lower psychism. He's come into his own. He's starting to have an experience of the higher senses, and and that's represented by him absconding without the blessings of the god Apollo, which would be the god of higher vision, that penetrating god that allows you to link with the soul, which is what the tripod is really aimed at doing. But anyway, thank you for that, Ariane. Well, okay, next up we have, we come to the familiar Lion of Leo. Unfortunately, I was unable, I tried for about 30 minutes, I was unable to find any reference to or info on the name Momphio. I think that's what it says. It might be a T. I don't know, and Veronica, if this means anything to you in Greek, or if anybody else has any insight on this, but I could find absolutely no, way of breaking this up in such a way that I could find any meaning to the word whatsoever.
No, unfortunately,
No,
it
no.
doesn't give me anything.
No, okay. And next up is Virgo, who is Isis, the mother of the world and the source of all fecundity, as symbolized by the sheaves. Notice that she, it's represented by the three, by the sheaves. Here she holds two, as she does here. Sometimes it's represented by three sheaves. Sheaves. Next comes Libra, represented by a man holding the familiar scales and what appears to be a rule. This is interesting. I bet this is a very specific object. Omphta is a variation on omphalos, which means center or navel, which is associated with a Libran point of balance. Also, interestingly, with the Oracle of Delphi, which was considered to be the center of the world. Next is Scorpio or Scorpius, here associated with the Greco-Egyptian Typhon, who was son of Gaia, the earth, and Tartarus, the underworld. This represents the lower aspects and regions of the natural world, which the disciple struggles to overcome through the tests and trials of Scorpio. Note the dual lightning bolts and the dual serpents of his lower body, which represents the illusion, glamour, and Maya of the lower quaternary. Typhon's tremendous power is highlighted in a Greek myth wherein he, by himself, battles Zeus and the entire pantheon of Olympian gods single-handedly, thus representing good versus evil. They finally defeated Typhon, imprisoning him beneath Mount Etna. But his presence was still felt through Etna's volcanic activity, which represents divine anger, but also renewal and transformation. There's so much more here about this, but in terms of just, quickly going through these 12, that's a thumbnail of Typhon. Next, we have Sagittarius, represented by the familiar centaur. The word nephte More commonly, neophyte or neophyte represents Sagittarius's propensity for exploration, learning, and seeking new experiences. Following Sag is Capricorn, which during the Greco-Roman period was associated with Anubis. The illustration, very curious, depicts an Anubis-like dog-headed figure holding a sistrum and a leash, suggesting that he has subdued the goat-headed fishtail creature associated with Capricorn, a sign that can represent both the chaotic and ambitious nature of earthly pursuits, and that seems to be what it's representing here, as well as the mountaintop of initiation. Since sistrums were used to invoke the gods, and the leashed sea goat suggests control over the lower instincts, this image probably represents preparation for initiation, which of course is associated with Capricorn. Of course, it's a much higher esoteric meaning to this sea goat, having to do with cosmic mystery of Capricorn. Next up, Aquarius, representing it by Artemis or Ephesus, evidently streaming forth the waters of life associated with Aquarius. Canopus is the second brightest star in the night sky, located in the constellation Carina. And though I could find no direct link between Canopus and Aquarius, Canopus's qualities are similar to those of Aquarius and to its rulers Uranus and Saturn. All are known for their transformative qualities. Canopus for transforming evil into good, Saturn for personal growth and opportunity, and Uranus for its revolutionary changes and innovations. And finally, Pisces, represented by Ixion, which means mermaid, the symbol for Pisces and Atlantean times. In this context, mermaids represent the matter aspect, the carpenter's square that she holds, right here, represents creation of order from chaos. You could also see it as representing the imprisoning square or cube, which the early stages of Pisces represents. Again, in this context, the little figure being held, see this little guy? And gazed at by the mermaid might represent a primordial human being. DK tells us that just as Cancer is a sign for incarnation of the human kingdom, Pisces is a sign of the first incarnation of each individual human being. Whether that's what's being referenced here or not, it's very difficult to say. So, any final thoughts or questions about this chart? It's fascinating.
Ben says the Aquarius water jug and the Canopus burial jars.
Yeah, I thought of that too. It doesn't, yeah, here we are. Yeah, this cornucopia, right? This abundance, and there may be an association there. It may have nothing to do with the stars. It may just be another word for that kind of abundance, which is certainly shown by this form and of Artemis, which was found in Turkey and one of the temples dedicated to Artemis. Thanks for that. Anyone else? Fascinating. Yes, Scott.
Did this at the bottom say when this diagram was made? Do we have a date on it?
No,
It's
what you see here is the entire writing of associated with this symbol.
okay.
You could probably do some research and figure it out, but I, yeah.
I think it's quite relatively quite modern, and it's exoteric, of course, as is that the ages of man division is exoteric as well, I think. This one, though, has seems like it could be even maybe 300 years old, 200-300 years old, because it's not uniform. It includes figures that are more alchemical and Masonic. In this, for instance, Libra is carrying a balance, but he's also carrying the rule.
Yeah.
And this relates to the Masonic officers. Whereas Pisces is carrying a square.
Right, both Masonic ideas. Yeah, that's interesting. Which would keep it, like you say, fairly modern, you know, since modern Masonry started, what, in London in 1777 or something like that?
17, yeah, it's when they...
Or 17, 1717, maybe, that's what it was.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, you know.
The character in Cancer looks like something out of something alchemical in Venice, it looks.
Yeah, I bet if, you know, an alchemist, or, you know, one who is familiar with alchemical texts might be able to shed light on some of these figures, especially that one.
And the fact that it's backwards or rotated 180 degrees,
right,
flip it, suggests another source as well. But I don't know. This is, I don't agree with some of these, the associations with them, with signs and the symbols and the names, but that's just me.
Well, not necessarily. You could, you know, they're not necessarily correct. You know, some human being created this, you know. So,
yeah, it started with Aries, with Libra rising instead of Aries, and putting Capricorn. It's obviously opposite, but
right.
We've run across this before. This where we've come across a Libra rising chart. Don't remember what that was about, though. It may have been something in Blavatsky. But anyway, it's an interesting chart, but...
But somewhat random.
it seems to me, just...
It's not, certainly isn't consistent in, for instance, its use of these... illustrations, you know, in terms of them, you know, representing, for instance, consistently one line of thought or one period of time, you know. So all of which also suggests that it's later, and, you know, they just drew willy-nilly from the past of what it might represent, you know.
Somebody's trying.
Yeah, for instance, Typhon's quite early, you know, extending up through Greek. I think Roman too, where there was some reference to Typhon, but that was it, you know. But anyway, thanks for your thoughts on that. All right.
We have a comment here from Ben that I'm going to read in a minute, but I wanted to point out, you know, as Scott pointed out, it appeared to start with Libra, but if you look at the house designations, it really starts with Capricorn. That's considered the first house, and the first decanate goes up to the 36th decanate in Sagittarius. So I just... You know, again, with Scott, it's a lot of inconsistencies in what we know now, but you think about whatever time this was put together, somebody put a lot of effort into trying to wrap their mind around what they had there. Now, Ben says Momphio or Mom... The other one with the T doesn't have a widely recognized meaning in modern languages. It's associated with ancient Egyptian and zodiacal symbolism. He also says hempta, also known as hempta, in other words, an apostrophe between the PH and the ta, is an Egyptian deity often associated with Jupiter. Hempta is described as a triform and pantomorphic deity, meaning it has three forms and can take on various shapes.
Well, since Jupiter is associated with Zeus and was considered, the primordial god, it would work, that Hympta would appear in this place of the pantomorphic deity, through one who can assume any form, because he's master of the three aspects, right? So, thank you. Who did that come from? Ben. No. Was it Ben? Who?
And
Ben.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Ben.
Yeah, great. And you actually found an association with Momphio or Momphtho. Wow. I didn't. So it's associated with ancient Egyptian or zodiacal symbolism, but no, nothing more about that, huh? That was for Leo. Anyway, interesting. Thank you very much. Yes, Scott.
I think we've seen these. The Cancer and Scorpios on Shar Cathedral. It goes back to that time for those. That's really medieval, early medieval stuff, the
I
Cancer.
was getting a medieval feeling about that as well. With Cancer and which one? Scorpio?
Scorpio.
Yeah. Also, this is a lot like the Abraxas. The Scorpio is a lot like the Abraxas symbol. Not identical, but yeah, similar. Huh. So on in Shart, there was this kind of bird-headed figure.
I don't remember that one. I remember the one on the outside, the
Oh,
that one,
this one,
yes.
yeah. Notice it's the same head in both cases.
Is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
Okay. Well, it's a fitting ending to this chapter. We've been on this chapter for about eight sessions. So,
Francis. Oh, sorry.
No, go on.
Ben says AI.
AI, what does that mean? You give
I
me that.
think it means that's where he got his info.
Oh, yeah, it sounded like AI. Okay. Yeah, I use AI too, and then I check up on what AI says because it could also feed you some really strange and completely erroneous stuff. I couldn't find even what you found about ancient Egyptian as astrology. I'm going to actually see if I can find any association there. Just curious. All right. Well, that finishes the chapter on the zodiac and its signs. Yes, I see another hand.
Joe, go ahead.
I just want to suggest that when you're doing your looking, I have looked for a goddess with many breasts for Aquarius, and there's a great deal on Google.
Well, this, I've actually seen this statue live in Turkey. Ephesus, that's where it is. It's the ancient temple of Ephesus, and she's in the museum. And she's is depicted here. She has many breasts, just like this. So it's not a made-up thing. I've never seen this seated bird-headed figure with its arms stretched out, however. Okay, when we turn the page, we come to the frontispiece and the first page of the next chapter entitled The Bimbing or Bimbine Table of Isis. The foldout printed in metallic silver on black in the folio edition of Secret Teachings is beautiful. It's beautifully rendered and highly detailed. This photo that you're seeing really doesn't do it justice. Here's the original Bimbine table of Isis, also known as the, in fact, much more commonly known as the Mensa Issiaka. Issi meaning is the prefix for Isis, who stands at the center here. It is an elaborate bronze tablet with enamel and silver inlay, created in a style that mimics ancient Egyptian art, but is actually of Roman origin, dating back to the first century AD. It was discovered after the sack of Rome in 1527, and was used by the antiquarians of that time to try to penetrate the meaning of Egyptian hieroglyphs, which were not authentically deciphered until the 19th century. Therefore, as enticing as it is to imagine the Mensa Issiaka as an esoteric key to the Egyptian mysteries, which apparently MPH did believe, it is unfortunately not that. It's to be kind, it's an inauthentic and inaccurate representation of the Egyptian rites, mixing motifs without consistent meaning and making it difficult to identify specific deities or rituals. Fortunately, MPH doesn't directly engage with the content of this image in this initial section, but rather uses it as a kind of backdrop motif to explore the rites and rituals of the Egyptian priests, which is what we're going to be looking into. Now, since I wrote this text, since I wrote these notes, I've done further study on this, and there was some significant and respected authors, for instance, Levi, in his History of Magic, who, full well knowing that this was of Roman origin, considers it a key, the first key to the Tarot, and also having depicting the 12 houses of the zodiac, and having other astrological meaning. So I've got to look further into this, you know, based on two or three authors who I respect who give this tablet credence, in spite of the fact that is not of Egyptian origin. So that's kind of where I am in the development of this thing. So we'll divide the text that appears, it's a very long text, that appears beneath the illustration into five parts. The text is almost entirely a quote from Athanasius Kircher's Oedipus Egyptiacus, who believed the Mensa Issiaka not only to be an authentic Egyptian artifact, but also to be an important key to their mysteries. Kircher's Oedipus Egyptiacus is the source of many of the illustrations that appear in Secret Teachings. So, could we get a reader, please, for the first part?
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
Concerning the theurgic or magic sense in which the Egyptian priests exhibited in the Bembine table of Isis, the philosophy of sacrifice, rites, and ceremonies by a system of occult symbols, Athanasius Kircher writes, "The early priests believed that a great spiritual power was invoked by correct and unabridged sacrificial ceremonies. If one feature were lacking, the whole was vitiated," says Iamblichus. "Hence, they were most careful in all details, for they considered it absolutely essential for the entire chain of logical connections to be exactly according to ritual. Certainly, for no other reason did they prepare and prescribe for future use the manuals, as it were, for conducting the rites. They learned, too, what the first hieromancers possessed, as it were, by a divine fury, devised as a system of symbolism for exhibiting their mysteries. These they placed in this tablet of Isis before the eyes of those admitted to the Sanctum Sanctorum in order to teach the nature of the gods and the prescribed forms of sacrifice.
Thank you. Okay. First, concerning the theurgic or magical sense in which the Egyptian priests exhibited in the Bimbine Table of Isis, the philosophy of sacrifice, rites, and ceremonies by a system of occult symbols, that's the introduction, Athanasius Kircher writes, so the magical practices performed by the Egyptian priests that we know about roughly fall into five categories. Can we get a reader for this, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Okay. One, healing rituals. Priests, especially those serving the goddess Sekhmet, performed healing rituals to cure illnesses and ward off plagues. These rituals often involved incantations, amulets, and the use of sacred texts. Two, protective magic. Lector priests, who were highly respected for their knowledge of sacred texts, performed rituals to protect the pharaoh and the kingdom. They used spells and charms to ward off evil spirits and ensure the safety of the realm. Three, funeral rites, funerary rites. Priests conducted elaborate funerary rites, rituals to prepare the deceased for the afterlife. This included the, quote, opening of the mouth, unquote, ceremony, which was believed to restore the senses of the deceased so that they could enjoy the afterlife. Four, daily temple rituals. Daily rituals in temples involved offerings to the gods, purification ceremonies, and recitations of hymns and prayers. These rituals were believed to maintain the favor of the gods and ensure cosmic order. Five, divination and oracles. Priests also practiced divination to interpret the will of the gods. They used various methods, such as reading the flight patterns of birds or interpreting dreams, to provide guidance and to individuals and the state.
Thank you, Scott. Any thoughts or questions? Okay, next. The early priests believed that a great spiritual power was invoked by correct and unabridged sacrificial ceremonies. If one feature were lacking, the whole was vitiated, says Iamblichus. Hence, they were most careful in all details, for they considered it absolutely essential for the entire chain of logical connections to be exactly according to ritual. Here's Iamblichus, De Mysteries, which means on the mysteries. The full title is On the Mysteries of the Egyptians, Chaldeans, and Assyrians, written in the 4th century AD. In this treatise, Iamblichus emphasizes the need for meticulous attention to detail and precise and unabridged execution in the performance of theurgic rites. Here's a list of steps taken in an Egyptian healing ritual. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
Can you hear me? Yes?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Purification. The priest begins by purifying himself and the ritual space. This involves washing with water and burning incense to clean any negative energies. Number two, setting up the altar. The priest sets up an altar with offerings such as food, drink, incense, and symbolic items like amulets, These offerings are meant to appease and attract the favor of the gods. 3. Invocation of deities. The priest invokes the relevant deities, such as Sekhmet for healing, by reciting specific prayers and hymns. This step is crucial for calling upon the divine powers to assist in the ritual. 4. Recitation of spells. The priest recites healing spells and incantations, often from sacred texts. These spells are believed to harness the power of the gods and direct it towards the healing process. 5. Application of amulets and potions. The priest may use amulets and potions that have been blessed and charged with magical energy. These items are applied to the patient to aid in their recovery. 6. Final offerings and thanks. The ritual concludes with final offerings and expressions of gratitude to the gods. The priest ensures that all steps have been meticulously followed to maintain the ritual's effectiveness.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, yeah, it's fascinating. And you can see how the lesser steps involved in each of these six, you know, would be myriad. And I'm sure they were codified into very specific forms taken by the priests at that time. And, you know, for those who are familiar with magic, even if just by reading, you know, certainly, which is the only way I'm familiar with it, that it is said that absolute adherence to the steps is essential for the magic to be effective and for protection. Okay, next. Certainly for no other reason did they prepare and prescribe for future use the manuals, as it were, for conducting the rites. They learned, too, what the first hieromancers possessed, as it were, by a divine fury devised as a system of symbolism for exhibiting their mysteries. So a number of Egyptian papyri on healing have survived, including the Ebers papyrus from 1550 BC, which contains numerous remedies and treatments for various ailments, including prescriptions and spells, incantations. We also have the Edwin Smith papyrus from 1600 BC, which focuses on trauma surgery and includes detailed descriptions of surgical procedures, diagnoses, and prognoses. 6 of the 42 books that came from Hermes Trismegistus were dedicated to the art of healing. So it's a great tradition in ancient Egypt, and it was the priest class that performed healing. Hieromancy was a form of divination that involved interpreting the remains of sacrificial offerings or sacred objects, and was used to gain insight or predict future events by studying the patterns and conditions of these offerings. And finally, these they placed in the tablet of Isis before the eyes of those admitted to the sanctum sanctorum in order to teach the nature of the gods and the prescribed form of sacrifice. Certainly these insights would have been recorded, but not in the Roman tablet of Isis. Okay, next up. Oops. Could we get a reader, please?
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Since each of the orders of gods had its own peculiar symbols, gestures, costumes, and ornaments, they thought it necessary to absorb these in the whole apparatus of worship, as nothing was more efficacious in drawing the benign attention of the deities and the genii. Thus, their temples, remote from the usual haunts of men, contained representations of nearly every form in nature. First, in the pavement, they symbolized the physical economy of the world, using minerals, stones, and other things suitable for ornament, including little streams of water. The walls showed the starry world, and the dome, the world of genii. In the center was the altar, to suggest the emanations of the supreme mind from its center. Thus, the entire interior constituted a picture of the universe of worlds. The priests, in making sacrifices, wore raiment adorned with figures similar to those attributed to the gods. Their bodies were partially bare, like those of the deities. They themselves were divested of all material cares and practiced the strictest chastity.
Thank you, Martha. I see a hand.
Go ahead, please, Ariane.
Sorry for the noise. Yeah, I have a comment and a question. They had an exhibit, an Egyptian exhibit in San Francisco that I went to a few times, and they had all these, well, first of all, they seemed to believe that like Ramses was responsible for all these exquisite monuments, because it's sort of like his, it's like graffiti or something. They have these like hieroglyphs that were probably, seems like they were added later. And then they had, there were these beautiful imposing statues. And then there were these like mummies of animals, including cats and various obscure animals that I don't really remember the names of. And they exhibited those too. And I just, you know, it reminds me that there's like one religion for the masses and one religion for the adepts. Even Jesus talks about that. And what my question to you is, Francis, that so the priests, were they, what were, what, who were the masters? Like when the masters were roaming in Atlantis, were they the priests? Were they the advisors to the pharaohs? Were they something else? Who were the masters, and what were their roles when they referred to the priests and the pharaohs and such?
Okay, well, first of all, in Atlantis, DK tells us that the hierarchy actually incarnated in order to guide the Atlantean race, that because the development of Manas was not yet, it was in its infancy at that time. It was mostly a chamasic race developing the emotional nature. And so there was what has since, the veils have been drawn since in terms of direct involvement in the development of the race. I think Egypt, which definitely belongs to the fifth root race and not to the fourth, is somewhat different. I think there were, especially in the old kingdoms, in the earlier stages, there really were masters incarnating, including the pharaohs, you know, and that they directly guided the race. And there's some indication that it actually was a different race than the those who were being guided, but there's not that much information on that particular point. But I think this lasted for thousands of years, actually, where there were, you know, for instance, the uraeus, which is on the forehead of the pharaoh, and on some gods and goddesses, represents this divine link. So it would suggest that one who was born to become a pharaoh was, in terms of where they stood on the path, was ready to assume that office and could wield, you could say, divine law on the physical plane. And I think that's what happened for some time, you know, even up through the middle times, the 18th dynasty, you know, but the later dynasties, what's called the third Egyptian period, I think that was withdrawn. It's seen that the quality of their art writings and associations that they made about their gods had changed significantly. And I think that period was, it was quote unquote mere mortals, you know, that moved into those positions. That's my understanding, you know.
So just to clarify, so you're saying that that when the masters roamed freely in the world, it was during the fourth root race or fourth round? What are you saying there?
Fourth root race was Atlantis.
Okay.
And they guided the race directly. They incarnated and helped guide the race directly. In the fifth race, the nature of the purpose of the race changed to mental development. And there was provided a different role. Now I think it's very much on the inner side, but during, I think early Indian and Egyptian and Mesopotamian cultures, that there were masters who incarnated and gave us, you know, one of them being Hermes Trismegistus, who would have been, you know, the great Egyptian avatar of that time, who was overshadowed by Pymander, you know.
Well, so what are the time periods when you talk about the transition from the fourth root race to the fifth root race? When did that happen?
Well, there was a great deluge and it wiped out the Atlantean root race. That was in a long decline before that. You know, a lot of the mythology around the flood, even that in the Bible, is actually referencing that great flood that was designed to end prematurely that fourth root race. And then the White Brotherhood, there were groups that went to every continent from Atlantis and reinstituted the ageless wisdom teachings in India and in among the Druids, also in Central America, in Mesopotamia, there was a strong, and then all around the Mediterranean, especially Egypt.
So can I just ask two clarifying questions? So this is like 98,000 years ago is what you're talking about?
It just depends on who you read, and it also which stage, for instance, of the decrease in power of Atlantis. You know, Plato describes the last island of Atlantis as being submerged 10,000 years before he wrote that material. Just when the White Brotherhood propagated other parts of the world from Atlantis is, you know, up for question. But it wouldn't have been in the early stages of the fall of Atlantis. It would have been near the very end. That propagation of the ageless wisdom was seeded the other parts of the world. I can't put a time on that. I don't think it was 10,000 years ago, though. I think it was much, much earlier than that.
Okay, and then one last question. When you say there's a transition from the fourth root race to the fifth root race, is this symbolic, like there was a shift in emphasis? Or are you saying that physiologically people took on different forms? Or what is the significance? Like what really...
It's a huge question. I'll have to be brief.
Yeah.
I think there's, you know, the forms developed by the Manu would have been ones more appropriate for the development of mind, you know, for the fifth root race. You know, we don't know specifically the forms of the fourth root race. They're all hierarchically overshadowed and you could say preordained that they will exist. Yeah, it's probably all I can say right now on that. It's a big topic, that one, you know. But it's run by, you know, the guidance comes from all three departments of the hierarchy, you know, the Manu for literally designing the vehicles for the race. The second department, the department of that's overseen by the Christ, would determine the nature of the avatars that would incarnate during a particular root race, and then finally the third is most active in guidance of whichever race is extant, shaping and guiding the nature of that race. I see another hand.
Yes, Martha, please go ahead.
This is a small contribution to what was just offered. The challenge I think we all have is, are we talking about the emphasis on consciousness, or are we talking about historical dates? And I'm pretty sure there's a lot of ambiguity about that. But I wanted to just offer, and I know many of you know this, that even in our fifth root race, there were always demarcations between degrees of consciousness, and whether you were a master or a student. And I was reminded of that when they were uncovering the floors in Notre Dame Cathedral, where they found that there were these demarcations during rituals that between the ordinary people and the so-called priests or celibates, and the such as nuns and things like that, and for me, the interesting part of the question is how much division was necessary in order to protect and preserve this emerging consciousness that was developing even throughout our history. And I think of the great invocation, Restoring the Plan on Earth, this return, restoration. I'm not a conservative, but I always feel something big is lost when we restore the plan on Earth as an invocation, because in fact, it's perhaps all of this is about tracking how these seed thoughts were coming into humanity and where we are now in terms of finding different ways of convergence, which is parallel to the scientific incursions of quantum understanding. So it's tough when you're doing comparative religion to remember all of the categories or all of this element components of what is historic thinking and what is consciousness rising. So the question, the big question is, was it symbolic or was it historic? I think nobody has really demarcated that clearly. That's my assumption. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a lot there to address. We're out of time. I will say that the unfolding of the egoic petals is related to the first three races, or I should, no, actually to the third, fourth, and fifth races, the first three strictly human races, with the first petal, which is development of the physical apparatus connected with Lemuria. The second petal, which is sentiency and emotional sensitivity, very much connected with the Atlantean race. And then the third petal associated with development of manas with our fifth root race. And so you have in that the appropriate forms would have been designed, you know, by the Manu of those races to optimize the opening of those particular petals. Now you have people who have who are still haven't opened the third egoic petal, and people who have opened all 10 and have are all 12 and have moved on into the and completely shattered the causal body. So it's just a loose association that is the determines the nature of the, you could say, the center point of humanity in relation to the development of the connection between the ego and the lesser self, right? Which is what the unfolding of the petals represent. There was so much more in what you said that we can't get to now, but thank you. Thank you, everyone, for participating. Do we have dates?
No, we're just going to make them. Oh, no. Okay, next. Next up, BCF on 14 February. Then the Secret Doctrine will be on the 16th of February. And our next Secret Teaching of All Ages is going to be on the 2nd of March.
So business as usual. You know, I strongly recommend that you make friends with the MoriaFederation.com website, because everything is listed there in the calendar, and you can always find these webinars and more, you know. So good. Okay, thanks. Thank you all. I'm looking at the last chats here. Yeah, okay. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.